Let's move you on from Parkland.
Yeah.
And what year did you leave there?
1966. I was going to Florida. I got a Florida license. I had a Texas license and Missouri license. Florida's very hard to get into. I had a partner down there. I had a telephone number in Broward County, and I was going to Fort Lauderdale. I didn't want to see any more trauma the rest of my life. And the Oklahoma Surgical Society came to Dallas, to Parkland, to the Marriott Hotel for one of their annual meetings. My boss, Dr. Shires, threw me a bunch of hotel keys. He said, go take care of them. You know, if they need a bar, they need a projectionist, whatever it is, if they want to come out here and watch surgery, drive their wives around, arrange taxis to take them to the art museums, whatever it takes. So I did, and I met Dr. Les Nienhuis, I met Dr. C.T. Thompson, and Dr. Dean Heide. They were three people who were forming a company called Surgical Associates in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And that was about it. They really thanked me, and that was about it. A few months later, a very well-known OB-GYN doctor in Tulsa married a girl that we knew, his second wife, and she said, well, we're coming down to Dallas on our honeymoon. We want to stay with you. I said, well, you know, for God's sakes, Emily, we're staying in a $90 a month house made out of cardboard, and somebody's going to have to sleep on the floor. I'm still working 36 on, 12 off. Let's not bother Jim with that. Get a motel room. But no, no, we're going to stay with you. They came. It was Jim Maddox, very well-known OB-GYN doctor. He's over at St. Francis, and the three surgeons or four surgeons there are talking about who are they going to hire to come to Tulsa. So Maddox said, you guys are damn fools if you don't hire Jerry Gustafson. I said, well, who is that? That's that surgeon down at Parkland. Like CT said, that's the guy that showed all our movies that we like so much. So Maddox invited me to his house and had a party with those guys, and that's how I ended up here. But I got my draft notice.
Vietnam War was on.
Yeah.
And your notice came. What did you do then?
Actually, I had 30 days to sign up or go in as a private. We went on a vacation. My wife's family's had a cottage in northern Wisconsin for years. So we went up there with the kids and wondered what was going to happen to me and her. She thought she'd be a widow or something. You know, it was just terrible. So I had to be sworn in to be commissioned. So I went over to the Hazelhurst, Wisconsin post office, where about an 80-year-old lady was in there, had a Bible in a drawer, and she hawked that thing out and swore me in as a commissioned officer of the United States. Isn't that amazing? And I said, have you ever done this before? Is there a charge? There's no charge. Have I done this before? She said, a lot.
Didn't she have to know your credentials?
I had a set of orders that said I had to do this in 30 days. Because I had registered for the draft in St. Louis, Missouri, I had to report to the St. Louis Armory at 7 o'clock in the morning on August 28, 1966, to enter the Army as a private.
She knew then by your papers, yeah, your education.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were sworn in. Then what?
There was some other literature that was forwarded to us that said, you're going to love the land between the lakes. They've got great schools here. This is Kentucky. Come on down. So I thought, we better drive by there on the way back. So we did, and it was Fort Campbell, Kentucky. We went up to the guards at the gate and said, where is the 71st Evac Hospital? And they said, oh, never heard of that. And they got on the phone and said, yeah, it's here. It's way back in transportation. Went back there, and here are all these big green metal boxes. 71st Evac, Vung Tau, Vietnam. Vung Tau is the name of the port off Saigon. Didn't know that until later. Boy, my wife broke out in tears. She said, you're going to Vietnam. This is it. We don't need to look at schools here. So we drove back to Dallas and kept the house that we were going to give up. She stayed there for the next year. So then the military got me, took me to Fort Sam Houston. They put us in basic training. Then we had some combat training for doctors. And then I got sent to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. That's a crazy place. Airborne Rangers, don't mess with them. Now, by this time, I was 31 years old. They would get doctors. And they'd have us all up at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, standing on a telephone pole, like a clothes rod, with 15 pounds of sand on each end, playing this game of trying to knock the other guy off the pole. And here'd be these 18-year-old kids, you know, and they whipped the doctors up something awful, you know. And they made us march. The airborne would throw gas grenades at your feet, because you always wore your field gear, and then you'd have to get the mask out, or else you were going to be having tear gas galore. I mean, it was tough. Shooting pistols and guns and stuff. And then we took off and took a boat to Vietnam, took the USS Darby from World War II, about 5,000 on board, 10 doctors from Fort Campbell, two Navy doctors who were just out of their internship. And people got hurt on board the ship. We took care of them. I did one appendectomy on board. We stopped at Okinawa for us to buy Christmas presents for our family at the PX. Then we went to Quy Nhon, Vietnam, not Vung Tau, which is up on the coast. Nobody knew we were coming. Nobody knew we were supposed to go. Didn't have a place to go or anything. So I went over to the 67th Evac Hospital, got a bunk, stayed there and waited. And I waited there the whole war.
You were a surgeon there?
Yeah, I was a surgeon.
Till when?
They gave me credit for my boat trip over, 28 days, so I didn't have to do the full 365 days. We left the United States on Halloween. We arrived there on Thanksgiving, and I came out of Vietnam on Halloween.
And you were awarded a Bronze Star?
Yes.
For meritorious service?
Yeah. Not valor. I wasn't killing commies for Christ, but I did a lot of interesting things. I've always been selected to do crazy things. I went to refugee camps and worked with cholera. Saw thousands of bodies being burned at one time. They'd all died of cholera. I saw people cupping their hands, just drinking liquid stool out of the streets because they were so dehydrated and they were going to get more cholera. I saw, argued with the Vietnamese government about, let's give these people cholera shots and chloramycetin, and they wouldn't give it, and they wouldn't waste that, and they wouldn't do that. Wondered why the hell we were over there, you know. Dealt with the 101st Airborne up at Phnom Penh. Found out that John Laird, one of my medical school classmates, was their medical doctor. He lived in a Swiss chalet on the side of a hill over what they call the golf course, where 600 armed helicopters came and a bunch of things. It was kind of fun to go up there and have a drink with him. They would have rockets stuck in their tubes that didn't come off. They had a big mountain there, and they would just drop that helicopter about 10 or 12 feet trying to mock. These things go and blow up on the hill. And that was our entertainment. But it was crazy. We took care of people at a leprosarium, which is interesting. I never saw lepers before. A Catholic group from France. It was marvelous. When you have leprosy, it eats on your sensory nerves first, so you don't feel anything, so you could go out and do amputations without anesthetics.
And you performed those?
Oh, yeah. And a guy in town named Jerry Sisler, who's an orthopedic surgeon, lives out at the Inverness now. It was a very unique situation that we dealt with there.
Leprosy was so contagious.
Very low-level contagency, very low. But I did see one case of smallpox. New Zealand doctors ran a provincial hospital, and they said, hey, you guys get your cameras, come down here and hold your breath and go in this room. Have you take pictures of a baby. Well, the other thing I did, I went up to Pleiku. They had several thousand North Vietnamese Army troops, not Viet Cong, but NVAs, in a prisoner of war camp. And they have to be inspected once a month by a doctor. And I got that. That's probably why they gave me the medal. I went up there, and, you know, the dogs would come sniff you. You couldn't go in with any shoelaces on. Couldn't have your belt buckle on. You have to bring a shirt with no rank on it so they wouldn't think they were going to get kill a high-level officer or anything. The commander of the camp was Lieutenant Colonel, ear, nose, and throat man, who had done his residency in Philadelphia, spoke perfect English. Isn't that outrageous?
And he was a Vietnamese.
Vietnamese, yeah. And we'd visit, and we'd have tea, and we'd go look at their latrines and the pits they'd dug, and ask him what he needed, and then he needed more white paint for his clinic, or he needed more beds. So I'd write these reports up, and it was always top secret. I'd get on my helicopter and put him in there and put the handcuff on. I had to carry a .45, the secret record and everything. I was a big dog, you know, had the MPs guard me. I'd fly back down there.
And again, that was a prisoner of war camp.
Yeah.
They were the prisoners that we had captured.
We had captured.
Well, you were a captain at the time,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, right. And that was a bummer because after my first year in the service, they brought doctors in as majors.
That's always something, isn't it?
Yeah. I did get home once. I did get home once for Vietnam, of all things. When highly respected officers needed to be transported all the way back to Walter Reed and they needed a doctor in attendance, we had this lottery. We had the Lucky B4 bag, which is a canvas bag that military carries. We'd reach in there and pull a number, and if you won the number, you got to go. I had a major who was an expert in helicopter repairs. He was playing volleyball and sprained his ankle, and somebody put plaster on his ankle too tight. He got a blood clot in his leg, and he threw one to his lung. He just about died. We had him on heparin and doing stuff like that. He may be instant CPR. He may be heparin. You know, you just got to stay with him. Doctors got to go. Nurses can't count. So I drew the number. C-130s came in, picked up. We had two C-130s a day. That's how many people we were sending out of 67th back. We had 12 general thoracic surgeons operating. We had orthopedic surgeons. We had eye surgeons. And boom, so we'd go to the Philippines, Clark Air Force Base. We'd overnight, and they'd take us to Sachikawa, Japan. We'd overnight. Then we'd go to Anchorage, regas up, and then arrive in Washington, Andrews. Then I had to find my own way home with a set of orders. I'd pay my own way to Dallas and spend 3 days with my wife, and then go to San Antonio, where they have a lot of Air Force bases, and then go over to Randolph or Kelly and say, you know, I need to go back. I'd got to Travis Air Force Base, and I didn't have enough priority to go to Vietnam real quick. They wouldn't give me a room because you might be called out of here any minute. So you just have to stay in the theater, doctor. So I spent 3 days living in the movie theater watching Modesty Blaze. Can you believe that? Boy, life's got to be funny or else it'll kill you.
Yeah.
So anyhow, came back from the Army.
You did a year then in Vietnam.
Yeah, 1 year.
You weren't under any fire there, were you?
Everybody's under fire. You know, it's insurgency kind of thing.
Okay, so you were. I didn't know how close you were to the firing line, but you were.
Yeah.
And so your wife back home, she's living on pins and needles because she knows that.
Yeah, she made a mistake. She became president of the Vietnam Officers Club or something. And a lot of people in Dallas were in the Air Force. They come in and say, oh, Sarah just lost her husband. He crashed in North Vietnam. You know, just terribly emotional thing. I mean, these people are just enmeshed like you wouldn't believe. Terrible.
But you survived that all and you came home then.
We moved to Fort Lee, Virginia, Kenner Army Hospital, which was really nice, but it was on the East Coast and things were kind of moving with Martin Luther King and the mule trains. The eight people that were always trying to raise a ruckus over there, whatever they call them. One time they were going to set 50 cities in America on fire. I don't know if you're aware of that. And in Fort Lee, Virginia, I couldn't live on the post because they thought that America was going to go underneath martial law. So people we knew were living there. They were studying how to run municipal water systems, libraries, bus systems. They were going to be able to go to places. Most Americans don't even know that they set fires in Detroit. They set a big fire up in Washington, D.C., a monstrous fire, right across from the White House.
What was the name of that group? It wasn't Black Panthers. Okay.
Can't remember all their names.
Yeah.
But anyhow, there was the quiet guys, like there were people reacting against Martin Luther, and there was the people reacting from the other side. And it was kind of messy.